This morning will be Lamont versus Savio.
Morning, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes.
Proceed.
Your Honor, this is a summary judgment case, premises liability involving inherently dangerous steps in a residential rental property here in Seattle. The appellant, Mr. Lamont, presented evidence to the trial court that the steps upon which he fell complied neither with the Seattle Municipal Code of 2009 or the 1937 Building Code. He had two experts which opined that the way in which he fell down the steps was, in fact, what was wrong with the steps not having complied with the code. He suffered 7 skull fractures, 4 arm fractures, a concussion. He was unconscious for an hour and a half. The landlord, in their lease agreement, said that they would maintain the premises and appurtenances in a sound and habitable condition. We respectfully submit that based on the evidence that we presented to the trial court that there was a tribal issue of fact here, and instead the court simply concluded that they couldn't find that the 2009 Seattle Municipal Code applied and therefore granted summary judgment. So we believe the evidence was sufficient to carry it to a jury, and we ask the court to reverse.
Counsel?
Stairway cases drive me nuts. This one has a lot of similarity to another one this court's had. As I recall, the declaration of your client is that he stepped on the first step down, which the experts measured and said is a normal rise and fall, rise and run. Your client's declaration never puts his foot in touch with a second step or another tread.
Okay. Well, first of all, Your Honor, it's not a declaration. It's his deposition.
Deposition testimony.
Okay. Well, it doesn't say that it didn't.
But how does the step that he never touches cause the fall?
Well,
it leaves open the possibility that he overstepped it, that he caught his heel on the first step, that he slipped on the landing, that the carpet was an issue. So, I mean, now we're into multiple causes and speculation, and, you know, frankly, you've got to address that.
Okay. Well, what I would say is that it doesn't say that he didn't step on the second step. It said
that doesn't help you, does it? Don't you have to get him to the second step to have a defect be the cause of the fall?
Well, the question is whether that's a reasonable conclusion from what the expert opines about how a fall occurs and the defect in the steps.
I would say everyone can understand that it could have happened that way.
Well, what I would cite the court to is the Martini case as to exactly what you have to prove. What you're concerned about is whether this is total speculation as to what occurred, and what the plaintiff would maintain is that he says he took that step, and then as he started taking the second step, it was as if his foot was in air, and then he tumbled over.
In air over his head.
Right. But it doesn't say that he did not step on the second step. So I would say that if you take...
Is your argument that the expert's opinion provides the missing link between the second step and the cause of the fall?
Yes. What I would say is that what you have to examine is it's natural to be skeptical about a situation unless you understand the science. And that's why we have an expert who explains that after you take that first step, and based on Mr. Lamont's testimony, as he's taking the second step down, it feels like as if he is in air. And that is where Dr. Hayes opines as to how the mechanics of the body move and how this occurs.
Let me tell you what troubled me about that. Your client's been up and down these stairs a number of times. And I asked myself, what's different this time? If he'd been a stranger to those steps, the expert's testimony would have been more compelling. But if the mechanics of the step is a fall as described by your expert, why didn't he fall the first time he went down the stairs, the second time, the third time, or the 40th time?
Okay. That's a great question. And here's my response to that. How many cases does the court face on a slip and fall on stairs where the party comes in says, in addition to my client falling, there have been 40 other falls on these stairs? That's not what occurs. What you have to do is look at how these stairs were designed. And that's what's so insidiously and inherently dangerous about it, is that it is in that particular time that you walk down the stairs, that you're misled. The fact that the carpeting on the stairs, as the experts report, the lip, the carpeting comes out, so they appear to be uniform stairs. But if you step on that, there's nothing underneath your foot.
So is the plaintiff's argument, appellant's argument here, that it's a reasonable inference that he had to have stepped on that step?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And what is the basis for that, the fact of the fall itself?
Yes. The mechanics of the fall.
That's a res ipsa argument, and this court's already rejected that.
Okay. Well, again, if you look at the opinion of Dr. Hayes as to the mechanics of how a fall takes place, it's a very reasonable inference that the way he's described it is the way that it occurred. And there's no countervailing testimony as to how it occurred otherwise. And remember again,
characterize Dr. Hayes' characterization of the fall as making it more likely than not, or that this is a possible way it happened?
More likely than not, Your Honor.
And why? What moves it from possible explanation to more likely than not?
Well, that is explained in the mechanics that he describes in his declaration of how a person steps.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is John Wiggenstein. I represent Respondent Quorum Real Estate Property Management. Matthew Pierce is also representing Quorum and Defendant Savio, the property owners. I'd like to take about 7 minutes of our 10-minute time to address the law and evidence issues. And Mr. Pierce is also going to then focus the remaining time on some of these evidentiary questions regarding the expert testimony.
Clock's running. It's up to you to...
Okay.
Get out of there on time.
I'll try to do my best, Your Honor. We had a fairly straightforward record from the proceedings below on summary judgment. And as we see it, this is a case that suffers from multiple defects in the plaintiff's claim that made the summary judgment appropriate. Putting aside the expert testimony issues that Mr. Pierce will address in more detail, the real thread that runs through the claim from Mr. Lamont, no matter how you characterize it, is the absence of notice and an opportunity and request for correction by Lamont to the landlord. If you look,
why is that required if the city code imposes a duty as a predicate to the right to rent the property to bring it in compliance with the code? The code itself is notice.
Well, it doesn't, Your Honor, and here's why. If we put aside the common law argument, the latent defect mechanism, which isn't even argued on appeal by Mr. Lamont, we then get to the issue of the Residential Landlord-Tenant Act and also the Seattle Municipal Code. The SMC specifically points out that it doesn't create a private right of action except in a couple of limited areas which aren't pertinent here to this claim. It does point out that it can be a predicate for a claim under the RLTA. If we look at the RLTA, it requires, before there's a violation of the Act, notice by the tenant under Section 070 of the RLTA and a reasonable opportunity for the landlord to correct the condition.
My point is the statutory obligation is notice to the landlord, apart from any notice by the tenant?
Well, then the question, Your Honor, is what is the statutory obligation? If we accept that line of reasoning, the Seattle Municipal Code says that construction of stairs must be to certain criteria with a certain rise and run limits on their variability. But it doesn't speak to maintenance of an existing stairway or existing premises. And that's what really this case comes down to when you boil it down, is Lamont wants the court to believe that there is a duty to inspect the premises and verify that it complies with all applicable codes. And, of course, that means the landlord's got to figure out what the codes are that supposedly apply, and then inspect according to the codes and preemptively bring things into corrective condition and compliance. That's not the law, not in the RLTA, not in the Seattle Municipal Code. And it's particularly interesting to see that after Mr. Lamont's fall, about a year later, the City of Seattle enacted a new portion of the Seattle Municipal Code dealing specifically with inspecting and certifying rental dwellings before they are let to the tenants. And not surprising, if you're going to see it in the state of Washington, Seattle's where you'd see it. It's a tenant-friendly jurisdiction, a municipality. And when the city chose to enact this new ordinance, it said, okay, there have to be certain inspections done of certain elements within the premises before you let the premises to a tenant. It has to be done by an inspector certified and qualified under this new ordinance scheme. The ordinance goes through and lists a number of things that need to be looked at, including fire, egress, things like that, just going from memory. Conspicuously omitted, though, is any reference to inspecting stairways for compliance with this SMC provision that the plaintiffs want to rely on, Section 130, which talks about the stair rise and run criteria. So I look at that legislative history, the history of the ordinance.
The fact that they don't inspect means they don't expect compliance? I mean, they spelled out the rise and the run. They spelled out a duty to maintain.
Maintain, yes. Maintain what's there. But Mr. Lamont is arguing
what's there was built contrary to the code that was in existence at the time of construction, which is one argument that's made.
It is an argument they make, Your Honor. I think it's a pretty doubtful one, because when you look at the 1936 code, which both our case law and the current Seattle Municipal Code say is the controlling one for those stairs, it says that those dimensions shall be uniform. And as we pointed out in our briefing, what does that mean? How uniform is uniform? Is it 0.005 inches discrepancy between treads? Is it a quarter of an inch? Is it an inch and a half? The landlord doesn't
know. Is that an actual question or a legal question?
Well, I think it's in the context we're here today, I think it's a legal question, because it gets to the issue of, is there a duty for the landlord to preemptively inspect? Our answer to that is absolutely not. If we had a common area setting, perhaps a different result, because those are settings where the landlord can have a duty to keep an eye on the common area that's shared with other tenants or between the landlord and tenant.
Is it your position that if I'm renting out a single-family residence, one tenant moves out, before the new tenant moves in, I have no obligation to go look at anything?
Yeah, that is my contention, Your Honor. I mean, unless you've been given notice of some kind by the tenant that there's a problem or an issue of concern, certainly you'd follow up on that. Even if we look at your hypothetical, if you walk through the house after tenant number one leaves and you're getting ready to clean it up and try to re-rent it, if you're going through there and you walk through and you see the rotting staircase with rotted stair treads, which we've seen multiple cases here in our...
I'd be really smart never to go in my residential house and always have someone else clean it up, wouldn't I?
Well, it depends who you have clean it up. If they're your agent, their knowledge may be imputed to you, and you're stuck with
that. Hire an independent contractor, huh?
Then you could do that, and then the question would be, what is it that you were going to have seen or that your contractor would see that would be a problem If you look at the rotted stair tread scenario, that's an obvious condition that a person can look at and say, gee, we have an issue here. The problem,
the batteries in a smoke detector last about a year.
Yeah, I think there's a special statute on smoke detector checking.
Well, maybe I picked a bad example, but let's pretend there isn't any statute. Since I have that general knowledge, do I have a duty to inspect the smoke detectors?
No, I don't think so. And again, here in the in this particular case, we had a detailed walkthrough of the premises with Mr. Lamont, where they went through all of the different rooms and parts of the premises. He checked off any issues of concern or damage that he might see. And he lives there a couple of months and is aware of the condition of these stairs. He admits it in his own testimony that he knew they were funky, that there were some rise and run variations. He didn't care about it. It was acceptable to him, and he never notified the Quorum or the Savios. Even after the fall, the really amazing thing is after his fall, he never contacted Quorum or the Savios and asked that something be done or complained that, hey, there's a problem with these stairs. Would you please come take a look at them? And to try to in that setting, say, oh, the landlord was supposed to be smarter than the tenant who had actual notice of the conditions, just goes against our long history of law in these landlord-tenant premises settings.
The remaining time includes counsel's time.
My apologies, then, Your Honors. If there's anything specific, I'll stay up here. If not, I'll turn it over to Mr. Pierce. Thank you.
I think the court hit the nail on the head in plaintiff or in appellant's opening argument. I think the testimony of Lamont specifically says, I proceeded to take another
identify
step.
Identify yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. Matthew Pierce from Helsel Fetterman for the Savios and Quorum. I proceeded to take another step downstairs. I had no footing. I was just in the air. Any
Is
symptom?
There a reasonable inference for the jury that when he says, I had no footing, it meant it slipped on the second step?
You know, that's an interesting question, Your Honor. Plaintiff, we raise this in the reply that there's a problem with plaintiff's expert declarations. No new declarations are put in. No declaration from the plaintiff explaining his deposition testimony to the extent he can do so. And we know that they could have done it because they did do it. They put in the supplemental declaration of Gill, and this is at CP 260 to 262. So we know where they think there's an issue, they'll put in some more evidence. They had the opportunity. They have the burden. If their experts need to clean up their declaration and put in a supplemental, they could have. If the plaintiff needed to explain his deposition testimony, he could have. Any further questions?
I think. Okay. Thank you.